Now Monitor brings you Meet the Press, the prize-winning interview program produced by Lawrence E. Spivak. Ready for the spontaneous, unrehearsed conference are four of America's top news reporters. Their questions do not necessarily reflect their point of view, but may be their way of getting a story for you. Now here is the moderator of Meet the Press, Ned Brooks.
Welcome once again to Meet the Press. Our guest is Lieutenant General James M. Gavin, who 5 weeks ago retired as the chief of the Army Division of Research and Development. His decision to retire focused the attention of Congress and the country on the controversy over the conduct of our defense program, especially the development of missiles and satellites. General Gavin had protested what he felt was a downgrading of the Army's mission in the overall defense plan. He concluded that he could do more for the defense effort by laying aside the uniform. So after 30 years of service, he retired. General Gavin has been described by Army Secretary Wilbur Brucker as one of the Army's most brilliant officers. During World War II, he served as the deputy commander under General Matthew Ridgway. At the age of 37, he was made commander of the 82nd Airborne Division, the youngest division commander in the Army. Since the war, as chief of research, he has played an important role in the development of space-age weapons, including the Nike anti-aircraft missile and the Atlas and Jupiter long-range missiles. And now seated around the press table, ready to interview General Gavin, are Ernest Lindley of Newsweek magazine, John Finney of the New York Times, Charles Cordry of United Press, and Lawrence E. Spivak, our regular member of the Meet the Press panel. Now, General Gavin, if you're ready, sir.
I'm ready.
Start the questions with Mr. Spivak.
General, in your testimony before the Johnson Committee, you said, and I quote, "I've watched the deterioration of our military forces with increased concern." Now, since Sputnik, the American people and the Congress have been aroused about this matter, aroused out of their complacency. Would you say we have overcome many of our deficiencies, the deficiencies that you worried about?
No, quite the contrary. The complacency that I felt was apparent at the time of the first Sputnik launching seemed to diminish somewhat, but perhaps the successful Explorer launching, as predicted, may have tended to cause people again to feel that the problems were behind us. My personal opinion is that we are far from out of the woods and we're in serious trouble.
Well, now you think that the Congress and the people have slipped back into their complacency. What about the military services, as you knew up to the date you resigned? Do you think that they have made any real progress in overcoming the problems they had?
Well, it is difficult to give substantive, finite numbers of this type of thing. It's a matter of measuring attitude. But I know that immediately following the Sputnik launching, it was just impossible to get any responsiveness and get decisions to do something quickly. Then a few things were done. The fact remains that the divisional strength of the Army has gone down to where it is now 14, and this includes the training facilities, and so the actual combat strength is much less. Then, too, our readiness for something less than general war is certainly no greater than it was before, and the idea still prevails, apparently, that if you can fight a general war, you can do everything else, which is a lot of nonsense.
General, since diagnosis is one of the first steps to cure, where do you place the responsibility for the deterioration of our military forces?
Well, I have stated before Congress that it is a matter of the decision-making processes of our government, and in particular of the Department of Defense. We've put quite a bit of money into the defense establishment. We've canceled programs occasionally, one amounting to $700 million after Mr. McElroy came in. And for example, $700 million into a satellite program 3 years ago would have made tremendous difference.
Now, are you saying that in spite of the fact that Sputnik is fully 7 months away, that these decision-making processes have not been sufficiently speeded up?
Well, there have been no, except for the addition of the new agency, ARPA, there have been no changes in the structure of the Department of Defense. Now, the new reorganization bill may be intended to address itself to that problem, but the same processes prevail, I presume.
So far, you feel that we're about where we were then?
Yes.
Mr. Cordray.
Well, General, do you feel that the President's reorganization plan will improve the situation by streamlining the command chain and circumventing the services on command decisions?
May I say, Mr. Spivak, in saying we are where we were, as far as decision-making processes go, we are essentially where we were. Money-wise, there's been more put into the program. Well, the reorganization bill, as I understand it, doesn't represent great change. I testified in an open hearing before the Johnson Committee on December 13th last year on this problem, and I urged rather strong radical changes, let us say. This bill, as far as it goes, is not very significant as I see it.
What should be added to it, General?
Well, in the first place, the same group of assistant secretaries to the Secretary of Defense remain, although I believe in lesser number. This has been one of the problems. Next, the Joint Chiefs of Staff remain also as such, and this too has been one of our problems, in that military advice on all facets of the military situation have not gotten to the Secretary of Defense. The advice comes through civilians who have a very high turnover rate. I believe it's 1.3 months, 1 year and 0.3.
Well, so, sir, in that connection, you once testified that you had requested a decision, and 10 months went by, and I gather nothing happened. Now, could you tell us who was responsible for that? What was responsible for it?
Well, I am not sure what the specific 10 months figure applied to. We've had a number of very long delays.
Situation?
I beg your pardon?
Was that a typical situation to have to wait 10 months for
it? It's not uncommon, let us say. In fact, some go beyond that.
Mr. Finney.
General Gavin, I'd like to turn to nuclear weapons, which you were so instrumental in getting the Army into the atomic age. From your knowledge, do you feel that it is essential that we continue atomic tests, or do we now have a sufficiently large and advanced family of atomic weapons?
Well, of course, the purpose of the test is not to give us more or make them larger. It's to make them more adaptable to combat needs, and the test should be continued by all means, in my opinion. We should bring fission into its most useful form to serve our forces, and this means give us an adequate air defense, a defense against missiles, and give us weapons for our forces in limited war that could be useful. Tests can give us these things, and they must be continued.
Well, in other words, for instance, we do not as yet have a warhead for the Zeus anti-ballistic missile.
Well, when I left the program, we were working on one at that time.
But it has not been tested.
It has not been tested.
General, how soon do you think we're going to reach the day when the ordinary foot soldier will be able to carry an atomic weapon into battle with him?
Oh, well, we have a program to accomplish that very thing now, and we should give the infantryman a shoulder-fired nuclear weapon in a few years.
Bazooka?
Well, you may think of a bazooka, but it'll be a much bigger tube, I presume, than that, so you'll get efficiency of yield of your weapon.
Size of a grapefruit?
Call it an oversized. You recall an article described it as a lumpy softball. I'd say it's about twice that big, anyway.
General, what kind of a situation are we going to be in when we have 100,000 troops, each with an atomic weapon? Aren't we going to be in a frightful situation where one soldier could trigger off a nuclear global war?
I don't think so at all, and I don't think we're ever going to have 100,000 soldiers, each with a nuclear weapon. This is quite far-fetched, you know. We will have 100,000 soldiers with, no doubt, the tens of thousands of weapons that Commissioner Murray has spoken about. And I don't think that they're having them will necessarily trigger a global nuclear war. Fission's here to stay, and we've got to learn to live with it.
Mr. Lindley.
General, last week on this program, Senator Clinton Anderson said that while the AEC is talking about and testing clean weapons, the military want dirty weapons and are even taking some weapons out of the stockpile and making them dirtier. Chairman Strauss of the AEC has disputed that. What, from your personal knowledge, can you tell us about that situation?
Well, I must say I was shocked to read that in the papers down in North Carolina. Our goal has been to get clean weapons. Dirty weapons come from fission. We've sought, therefore, to get fusion weapons down smaller and smaller to tactical size, and sought to get weapons so fabricated that they would be clean. Now, you cannot tell what a clean weapon is without knowing a dirty one, and we have therefore considered the parameters of cleanliness and dirtiness for the purpose of developing clean weapons. So one can say that we have considered dirty weapons. Yes, this is true. But of course, the object of the test for the Army's point of view have been to get cleaner weapons.
You don't know of any cases in which bombs have been made dirtier and put back in the stockpile?
Well, not to my personal knowledge. However, again, this has been talked about. We have had two distinct schools of thought in this country since 1946, I suppose. I know since 47. One, that we should make weapons as destructive and as large as man can make them, and the other, we should make them as small and clean, as tactically useful as we can make them. Generally, the Army goes along with the cleaner ones. It's possible to have been some made large and dirtier, but I just don't happen to know about it.
General, do you hold to the view that all wars in the future, if there are wars, will be fought with atomic weapons? Or must we be prepared to fight with conventional weapons also?
Well, we must be prepared to fight with conventional weapons, but there's no such thing as an adequate air defense without nuclear weapons anymore. Nuclear weapons are not in one category and conventional in another. Nuclear weapons are in all services, working their way right down to where the infantry will carry on themselves. Now, there will be a case for applying power without nuclear weapons, of course, in small conflagrations and disorders and so
on. Then you would not nuclearize the entire Army?
Well, I would make it as nuclear as I could make it and still have a good effective Army. We better get into this business more than we are now into it. I call to your attention the Soviet nuclear weapons displayed on the 7th of November in the Red Revolution Parade. Very effective weapons. And there are statements that if war comes, it will be a nuclear war.
You spoke of anti-aircraft defense. May I ask you, do you think that a really tight defense against missiles is feasible?
Yes, I do.
How tight?
How tight is tight?
Well, I don't know. If we're subjected or threatened with a nuclear bombardment with long or intermediate range missiles, have we got a chance of knocking most of them down?
Well, I believe we do. As you know, I have been concerned with this problem for a long time. I was almost shocked by the complacency 2 years ago on this problem. It's been most difficult to get people to pay any attention to defense against missiles, yet we could see the operational availability of a ballistic missile to the Soviets just on the horizon. So 2 years ago, testifying before Congress, we began to urge funding. We couldn't get money for it. Last year, the same way. I was asked if what we sought, and I said that I sought 100% effectiveness in defense against missiles, and I hoped we could attain it. This would mean that our defense would be so impressive that no one would throw an ICBM at it. Now, an ICBM represents a tremendous investment. Our Atlas is out at around $17 million. Well, you just don't shoot one of those unless you think it's going to go somewhere. Therefore, it seems to me that you can create a defense so impressive that with hesitancy they would attack.
Mr. Spivak.
General, how much progress have we made in the development of anti-missile missiles? Is this all in the talk stage, or have we made some progress?
No. It's beyond talk. It's beyond study. It's into development now, and components have been developed. And it will soon, if it is not now, be in the testing stage. I am not sure of the operational date of missiles of that sort, nor am I sure that the operational date should be put on the air here. But we can see clearly ahead of us now. I might say that the more we've worked with the problem, the more respect we have for it. We can see many complexities that we did not anticipate in the beginning.
When you say that we can build an effective anti-missile barrier, you mean not 100% in the sense of knocking down every missile that comes over, but enough so that we can't be taken by surprise, which is the thing
I would
that
say yes.
We fear most?
Yes, I would say yes to that question, yes.
General, one, I'd like to ask you a question on the reorganization, the president's reorganization plan. I couldn't quite make out from what you said before whether you were for the president's reorganization plan or against it, or whether you were for some of it and against some of it. You agree that the Defense Department needs reorganization, don't you?
It needs reorganization, and it would be difficult to be against it because it represents a very small bit of progress. I presume that those who are sponsoring it have in mind where they go from here, because it hasn't gone far enough at all. We've got to do better than that bill now provides.
Well, what would you put your finger on as the most serious problem in the Defense Department?
In my personal opinion, it is getting competent military advice to the Secretary of Defense in all of the areas in which he is concerned. Now, the JCS just concerned themselves with one thing, that is operations and plans. Now, Mr. Lovett complained about this, and in his famous letter of 1952, said that he had to keep sending administrative matters into the JCS and keep them constantly tied up with administrative problems. This is true, and this has gone on. Actually, the Secretary should have senior military officers who do advise him directly. At the present time, in the present law, the National Defense Act of 47, and in the proposed law, the military people can only be assistants and I believe it's aides. And they cannot take an executive position nor participate in the decision-making processes. This is a real serious deficiency.
And you're saying that under the president's reorganization plan, it is still possible for the Secretary of Defense, who will get increased power, to be ignorant on many matters of real importance?
Well, yes, Mr. Spivak, it is not only possible, but we have the same array of assistant secretaries giving them advice on matters such as they've been giving them advice on for the past several years, when we have begun, obviously, to lag in the satellite race and in the missile race.
Mr. Cordry.
Well, General, would you say that the reorganization plan should make some provision for space operations? Is there anything in there that impresses you?
Oh, well, yes. As a matter of fact, I noticed that in the commands that now report to the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and that is the Alaskan, the European, the Far East, there's no such thing as a space command. Now, if the reorganization is being undertaken with an eye to the future, certainly we should now think of the problems of strategy and tactics in space. And it's not too late, because the hardware is in development. And in fact, the hardware should be developed in response to a concept. So there should be a space command, in my opinion, under the JCS.
Well, going from space to the foot soldier for a moment, General, can you tell me why the Army is so much interested in outer space, when it says the big problem we face is the limited war and it has limited funds? Why isn't it devoting its funds to the limited war preparation?
Well, it is.
And but leaving Army, outer space to Army, someone else.
The Army, I would say, out of an honest sense of dedication, is more interested in the United States and its future than it is in the Army per se. And we have real competence in the missile satellite field, as we have demonstrated. And if we can give this to the country in any way, we feel that we should be allowed to do it. Furthermore, we are going to learn a great deal about space. Next, the Army has a mission to provide worldwide communications for all of our forces. This can better be done today through a satellite, a communication satellite, than it can be through terrestrial communications. Next, the Army has a responsibility for worldwide mapping and geodesy. This can better be done through a satellite. The Army has real requirements that should be met through a space program.
Mr. Finney.
Well, General, what is all the urgency to get out in space? From a military standpoint, can't we wreak all the destruction we want from missiles launched from the ground? What is the military priority to get out into space?
The object of a military establishment is not to wreak destruction, but to prevent this from occurring. And today this will be done by controlling space. And any strategic planning done fails when war comes. It should be so effective that we just simply keep war from occurring. And the man who controls space is going to control what happens on this planet, so we've got to get out there. We definitely will be inviting trouble if we fail to.
Well, General, you know, from a physical standpoint, it's much more difficult to launch a weapon from a satellite flying around than it is to launch it from the ground. And I just don't quite understand what kind of a weapon system you envision up there.
Yes. Well, I will not agree with you. You will say that it is more difficult. Well, it may be today, but I'm not satisfied that it's going to be tomorrow. But a satellite today is the reconnaissance element of an ICBM system. What gets a target for an Atlas or an ICBM? It must be a satellite. A manned bomber can't go, so how can a manned reconnaissance plane go to get targets?
All right, General, let's pose a hypothetical case. Suppose in the next year or two, a 2-ton satellite came over and we suspected a Soviet satellite and we suspected it had television in it. And it was up, 300 miles orbiting around. Would you shoot it down if you could?
Well, now, if policy requires a capability to do this, we should get on with developing this capability. I would say that we could not long tolerate detailed photographic analysis of our entire country from end to end conducted daily and just do nothing about it. Because, again, this is part of a weapon system. A weapon system consists of not only the weapon, but the reconnaissance element. And a satellite is the reconnaissance element of an ICBM system. You couldn't tolerate this.
Mr. Lindley.
General, a moment ago, you indicated that our difficulties, our lag in the past, was due not alone to organizational defects, but lack of vision or foresight or wisdom on the part of people in key positions. As you know, Defense Secretary Wilson's record has been criticized and defended. I wonder if you would give us your estimate of the job Mr. Wilson did as Secretary of Defense.
Oh, I would hesitate to have much to say about what Mr. Wilson did. I think at times he worked under difficulty. Of course, our experience with him in the Army was a most unhappy one. We had 27 divisions. He ordered us to absorb the training divisions in the divisional count, and then cut down the divisions, and then to create paper divisions. And we ended up with about a half a dozen operational divisions today. At this very time, all the strategic lessons were indicating that we had to go just the opposite direction. We had to be more and more ready for limited war. So from our point of view, we were rather unhappy about it.
Well, I believe Mr. Wilson has said, though, that he put the Army into competition in the missile field and the space field with the Jupiter, or encouraged...
Mr. Lindley, the Army was in the missile business in 1951, and we had a mid-range missile authority at that time because no one thought it was important. Mr. Wilson denied us that by his memorandum of 26 November and limited us to 200 miles. This at the time when we found out the Soviets were actually fielding long-range missiles. As a consequence, we have the Army today deployed overseas, facing an opponent that it can't defend itself against and can't shoot back against.
How would you estimate the record of the Deputy Secretary Donald Quarles, who was both under Mr. Wilson and is still there?
I'd rather not comment on his performance.
You'd rather not.
He's up there now.
Have you watched or observed the new Secretary of Defense, Neil McElroy, long enough to form an estimate of his capacity?
Well, I have said before Congress, I think he's first class. He's a very fine man, one of the best men I've seen in Washington in my time.
Then you would agree that this problem of running the Defense Department properly is not just a matter of organization. It's a matter of getting the right people in the key
positions. Absolutely. Yes, sir. I would.
Mr. Spivak.
General, do you think it would be possible for the Soviet Union, as of today, to destroy Europe or us with hydrogen bombs without contaminating themselves?
Well, this is quite difficult to say. They would certainly contaminate themselves some, but it's possible through the airburst of a significant number of hydrogen weapons to create enough destruction that you would say Western Europe were destroyed without much contamination on their part.
The question I really mean to ask is, can we have an all-out nuclear war without destroying ourselves? And as well as the other fellow.
If you mean a free-for-all exchange of thermonuclear weapons,
that's
just
right.
Let the stockpiles go, no. The contamination will be worldwide.
And this would really, in effect, destroy the world, wouldn't it?
Major segment of it.
Would you have to deliver your bombs to do that? I mean, we talk a lot about our delivery system, but suppose, for example, the Soviet Union started a war against us and we decided that this was either victory or slavery, and we just dropped our bombs anywhere the wind blew. Couldn't that destroy them as well as ourselves?
Well, yes, the damage could be just extensive, yeah.
Mr. Finney?
General, you made a statement a moment ago that because the Soviet Union now had long-range missiles, our troops could not defend themselves. You really don't mean that, do you?
If the Soviets have a missile that is, let us say, 750 miles, and this is today's long-range artillery, and we've known this for some time, and the best missile we have is, what, 75 miles? You, as an army commander, are placed in a not an intolerable but a fantastic position because you cannot retaliate and you do not have a missile to defend against that missile, and all you can do is remain passively dispersed, hoping to engage his forces with other types of weapons when they come in.
But, General, you're completely ignoring your sister service, the Air Force. They have a capability here, don't they?
Not if there's a missile defense that exists, and there were missiles displayed on November 7th, surface-to-air, highly mobile systems, and a manned fighter bomber is completely a bow and arrow against such things.
Mr. Lindley, a short
question. General, apart from the things we've discussed so far, what do we need to do to strengthen our military position?
Oh, I would feel better if, fundamentally, if we as Americans came to a realization that we've got to do more than just be against communism. We've got to be for something assertively and aggressively for it, support our programs. I think more of the national product should go into our defense program.
How much more?
General, I'm sorry, but I'm going to have to interrupt. I see that our time is up. Thank you very much, General Gavin, for being with us.
Our speaker was Lieutenant General James M. Gavin, former Chief of Research and Development for the Army, facing the panel of Meet the Press reporters, the program produced by Lawrence E. Spivak.
Now, Ben Grauer with this message.
You know, the easiest thing in the world is to dream of all the things you want in life, but it takes some doing to make those dreams come true. The best way to start is to put part of your earnings and savings and part of everything you save into United States savings bonds. And with Series E bonds, your money works for you while you save. In just 8 years and 11 months, you get back $4 for every $3 you invest. Saving is easy, too, through the payroll savings plan, a plan which you can engage in where you work. You see, your employer puts aside your savings for you each month. So get on the bond wagon. Make those dreams of yours come true. Make them come true by investing in United States savings bonds.
Thanks, Ben. This is where you leave the workaday world, isn't it?
Well, I guess this is it. Frank Gallup and I, and now you, have been going through this weekend with Monitor.
Yes, and I particularly enjoyed the fishing roundups today. They were extremely interesting.
Well, there's a new specialty which we're going to have Frank do next week. It's going to be he's going to give a specialized study on acrobatics in the Soviet Union.
Also, how to push himself up from the floor at arm's length.
Like
good. Right, Ben. Dave Garraway will be sitting in shortly here at Radio Central, and all the regulars will be on tap, too. Bob and Ray, Fibber McGee and Molly, Bob Hope at Al. I don't know who he is, but stay tuned.